I want you to think about a couple of words, insider and outsider, and what they mean to you in both this election year and this economy. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Politicians love to call themselves outsiders. It's a thing they do to prove their connection to people not in traditional power centers, like, say, New York and Washington. One of the great ironies of this is that they often do it while running to become insiders. But this insider-outsider framing is particularly relevant this year, and indeed after a period of economic growth where you could argue those at the top, the insiders, benefited much more than those in the middle or at the bottom. This week, we have stories of insiders and outsiders in Cleveland, around the country, and even in Brazil. So stay with us and share your thoughts at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We're starting the week off with our segment Long and Short. That's when we make some bets on or against things in the news, but do it using the language of finance. And this week, we bring you a special convention-themed edition. We have Marketplace's DC reporters Kimberly Adams and Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Nancy has been in Cleveland all week covering insiders and outsiders at the Republican National Convention, and Kimberly is headed to Philadelphia this upcoming week to cover the Democrats. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I want to start with you, Nancy. Why don't you go ahead and tell me your long, because all of the things you guys have are sort of knit together. Nancy, start us off.
Well, my long is that cities will continue vying to host these political conventions, in spite of the fact that the jury's still out on whether the cities actually profit that much from conventions. Funnily enough, most of the studies on this have been paid for by host committees, convention host committees. And I've talked to a lot of people about this. I talked to a local economist who said, yes, this has been great for Cleveland. We've had all this infrastructure improvement. And then I talked to another economist who said, "Nah, that infrastructure stuff would have happened anyway. And all the sales taxes and hotel taxes and so on won't add up to enough to pay back the taxpayers for everything they spent preparing for this." In spite of all that, though, I think cities are going to continue saying, yeah, we'd love to have 70,000 people descend on us. Bring it on. We'll host a convention.
And then regret it when they're sitting in traffic.
Exactly. Well, or they can't get to work.
And I guess one way to think about it is, listen, if you're, let's say you're Cleveland, you have had, gosh, a lot of people just saying Cleveland over and over and over again for the past few weeks. And you know, that's got to help somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. And the head of the Cleveland Host Committee told me, look, you know, we in the past, we've not been able to attract other types of conventions because we just don't have the facilities. We don't have enough hotel beds. And he said, look, now we're on the map. We have the hotel beds, and this is going to enable us to attract more conventions in the future.
Kimberly, I feel like your long goes along with this pretty nicely. Tell us that one.
So I am long on local TV stations, and I'll go ahead and throw in local radio stations, too, because, I don't know, I'm on the radio. I like it.
Yeah, you're on the radio team.
Radio's better than TV.
Yeah, way better than TV. But in particular, because now that we are into the general election campaign, we are going to see so much money going into ads on television and on radio for this presidential campaign. Just since Clinton clinched the nomination for the Democratic side, she has aired, or she and her surrogates and the super PACs and all the people supporting her, 30,000 ads just since she knew that she was going to be the nominee.
Wow.
More than 30,000 ads all over the country. Trump, none, because he's still relying on free media. But one of the things he's been doing at the convention, as I'm sure that Nancy has seen, is trying to drum up support, start doing more fundraising, because now he doesn't expect that he can finance the general campaign by himself, because he's going to have to start running ads. And where does all that ad money go? Local TV and radio in very targeted districts. So I think that local TV and radio are probably going to get a little boost. That's interesting, because even as local newspapers keep shutting down, TV and radio seem to be doing all right, maybe because they get this influx of cash every 4 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a huge influx. You know, what's really interesting is the candidates get kind of a discount on these ads because the federal government regulates how much they can be charged. But guess what? The TV stations can charge the super PACs whatever they want. Uh-oh. There is no regulation on how much they can charge the super PACs. So, man, are they rolling in it.
All right, then. So the flip side of this, you would expect that all of the local businesses that have, you know, customers nearby, et cetera, in these host cities would do well. But Nancy, on your short, not so much, you think?
You know, it really depends who you're talking about, Lizzie, right? So if you're talking about a big hotel chain that's got, you know, 3-4 hotels scattered around the region that are completely full this week, they're doing great. If you're talking about a restaurant that's catering a dinner for a group of delegates, they're doing great. But I talked to a lot of small businesses, in particular some businesses that are sort of tucked away in an atrium that is only a block and a half away from the convention center, from the arena where the convention is being held, but it's outside of the security perimeter for the convention, and they have really been hurting. And they bought all this extra stuff specifically for the convention that they may not be able to sell after. And they've opened later and they're opening earlier and staying open later. They've hired extra staff and they don't know what to do. One store owner I talked to at the beginning of the week on Monday was just distraught. She said, normally we make $100 an hour, or we sell $100 worth of product per hour. We're selling 65. That was Monday. I talked to her again on Wednesday, and she said things were about average, so a little over $100 per hour. But she said, you know, okay, about average, but I would expect with all these extra people in town, it would be way above average. So some of the small businesses are really disappointed.
I'm so surprised by that, but I think this is in many ways a sign of our times when you talk about the security cordon that exists in these modern conventions, that really changes the geography of a convention zone to inside and outside. And, you know, those outside just don't quite have the advantage anymore.
They don't. And in fact, there's actually a marketplace right next to the arena. inside the security zone. And there are about 23 businesses there, mostly small businesses who were handpicked. And they're doing great because they have a captive audience. The delegates, an estimated 20,000 delegates cycle through there every day. So there are sort of, you know, these insiders and outsiders, the insiders in the marketplace right next to the arena and the small businesses outside that are having a hard time.
All right, I want to spin us away from conventions a little bit because, Kimberly, your short's a little different.
Yeah, I'm going to step away from politics, but as any political journalist or journalist in general, I'm obsessing over Twitter all the time. And so I couldn't help but notice this week the epic trolling of Ghostbuster star Leslie Jones. And so I am going to go short optimistically on organized Twitter trolling, because as a result of these terrible racist and misogynist comments that were just hurled at her and her deciding to leave Twitter and engaging with
And we should say that Twitter then suspended really the instigator of those things, or banned permanently.
They say they permanently banned him as a result of this. Also in response to that, Twitter issued a statement saying that, look, we know that we have a problem with this and we haven't done enough in the past to address it. And we're working on it. And this has been a criticism I hear a lot, particularly from women and people of color, even more specifically women of color, that there are certain types of harassment and online harassment that Twitter and Facebook just, they ignore it. And so now there's been a much louder outcry saying, you guys have to do something about this. And it seems like companies like Twitter are listening and looking for ways to respond. Twitter has rolled out a new program to allow more users to have access to the verified status, which may be a way to address this. And it looks like there is at least a concerted effort to do something about this. So I'm going to go optimistically short on the organized Twitter trolling.
But it seems like it takes them forever to do anything about this. I mean, does it have to get to this level before they do something?
Apparently.
Yeah, it seems like it has to. I mean, this is, I think, a fascinating thing. As more and more of our public discourse is online, we have to remind ourselves these are private companies. And so much of this discourse, we think of it as in the public sphere, and yet it isn't, because it's controlled by terms of service and user agreements and things where, you know, traditional free speech law may not apply.
Yeah, I saw quite a few people posting on Twitter this week, you know, there's no First Amendment on Twitter.
Kimberly Adams and Nancy Marshall Genzer, thank you both very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. So that insider-outsider thing that I talked about at the top of the show, Marketplace has a new pop-up podcast this election season to examine that premise and how it affects us. It's called Politics Inside Out, and our Washington bureau chief, Andrea Seabrook, took to the floor of the convention and to the streets of Cleveland. Here is Drew Bascom. He works at a high-end restaurant in Cleveland, and he sees himself as one of the outsiders.
I'm ready for everybody to go home. I don't care. I'm just ready for everybody to go.
What do you do? What's your job here?
I'm a line chef.
A line chef?
Yeah.
So you're like cooking the food for all these people.
Yeah. You know, I play fair. I cook the food. You know, it's just me personally. I feel like this ain't got nothing to do with me. Because no matter what happens, it's still going to be the same BS that we see every day as us being a black man, flat out. And then no matter what race you is, the only color that matters right about now is green, flat out. So
you mean money?
Yeah, money. Yeah, everybody talk about Donald Trump did it, Donald Trump that, but as y'all can blindly see that Donald Trump don't care about what's going on. He just care about, I don't know what he care about, because he's halftime, he sound like he don't know what the hell he talking about. You know what I'm saying? You know, I just, like I said, I just can't wait till everybody go home so I can get back to reality.
And we're doing this again next week. Andrea and Kimberly Adams are headed to Philadelphia to bring you Politics Inside Out from the Democratic National Convention. We're obviously pretty into numbers here at Marketplace, which is why every week we take a look at some of the biggest stories in the news by the numbers. Here are Marketplace producers Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills with this week's news by the numbers. Take it away, Eliza.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
10.
That's how many NFL games Twitter will stream this season.
Combine that with 150 Pac-12 games, both political conventions, and, just announced this week, original programming from the NBA. And it's clear that Twitter is making an effort to be not just the place you talk about live TV, but watch live TV, too.
Whether anyone actually wants to watch college water polo or NBA warm-ups is another question.
96 minutes.
That's how long Aquila, Facebook's new plane, flew in its maiden voyage last month.
Yep, while Twitter is trying to manufacture more relevance, Facebook is aiming, higher?
The goal is eventually to build a fleet of these solar-powered drones that will stay in the air for months and beam internet access around the world.
68.
That's the median age of Fox News primetime viewers, according to Nielsen.
Compare that to 59 over at CNN.
Fox still has the highest ratings of the cable news channels and raked in $1.5 billion in profits last year.
But as the network parts ways with longtime chief Roger Ailes, a bigger problem is right around the corner.
A huge chunk of its audience might not be around much longer.
Last week, in the spirit of the Republican and Democratic conventions and the political compromises they often require, we asked you to tell us about financial compromises and negotiations you've made. We got stories about how to split the check, what to tip. Katie Lotz in New York City is in the middle of a negotiation involving friends and a new place to live.
I'm going to need a new apartment in the fall, and it's already giving me tons of anxiety.
And is this about compromising with other people over money?
Yeah, well, part of it is I'm looking to move possibly with two of my best friends from high school, but we all make different salaries. And so depending on where we live, obviously will depend on how much we're each paying rent. So it's a big compromise of location and then also how much rent each of us will be paying. And I know already, even though it's not for a few months, that it's going to start raising some tensions. And then also just the thought of possibly having to pay a broker's fee just makes me feel so ripped off. So that's another layer, because I know one of my friends will probably want to use a broker, but I and my other friend most likely will not, because we won't want to pay the fee. So there's a lot of compromising that's going to have to happen.
So how do you deal with that? I mean, do you guys talk about it up front? It sounds like you've known each other for a long time.
Yeah, I've known them both since fifth grade. So they're my really good friends. I've talked about it with each of them separately a little bit. So at this point, it's sort of just this idea of it'd be so great if we could live together. And I think it's the summer now. People are busy. It's not as focused, but I know next month we're going to have to sit down and we really are going to have to just sort of hash it out. And each person is going to have to say, like, this is what's really important to me. Like, I won't pay over this. And then we'll have to either decide if we think we can make it work or if we can't.
Are you worried about your friendships?
A little bit, just because I don't want to get kind of so far in the process of us looking for a place and then decide that it's like I'm not willing to actually pay a certain price and then have to back out and then my friend be angry at me. My last apartment that I lived in, it did get sort of touchy because, again, I lived with two people and one of my friends was willing to pay more than me and my other friend. And in the end, she compromised and we got a cheaper place. And to make up for it, she got the biggest room. But throughout our living there, there was still always side comments here and there of like, if we didn't live in this place or things like that. So I think ultimately it did kind of affect our friendship.
So what did you learn from your past experience that you want to carry over into this one?
I think for this new situation, I've learned that it's very important to just be upfront about exactly what I'm looking for and sort of the compromises that I'm willing to make, because it doesn't really serve anyone to sort of be wishy-washy and kind of go along with it, but then in the end, not actually want to commit to what I said I would commit to.
Katie Lotz, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Compromises involving money can be uncomfortable. We all have our own ideas and values and different approaches even to talking about money. So to sort through all of this, we've got Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst. Welcome back.
Great to be with you.
When you're thinking about negotiations and compromises, are there different ways to approach it if you're thinking big stuff like a salary versus little stuff, you know, splitting the check with your friends?
Well, I mean, look, each one of those situations has some weird, fraught parts of it. Obviously, the bigger the dollars, the more attention it gets. But I do think that we tend to put a bit too much emphasis sometimes on these big negotiations and sometimes really do kind of become our own worst enemies. Let me give you an example of that.
Yeah.
You know, you can see somebody sometimes digging in around, say, a house negotiation. And for some reason, you know, we get attached to these houses. It's hard. I understand it. But when you get down to it and you start looking at, say, $10,000 either way, and then you kind of remind yourself, but wait a second, I'm spreading this out over a 30-year mortgage. And am I really willing to put that line in the sand, miss the house that I want over a few bucks a month in a payment? And when you break it down that way, you start to say, you know what, I'm not that proud. I want the house. And so I think it is helpful sometimes to have the numbers guide you simply to just remind you, like, sometimes the actual dollar amount, this big dollar amount that means so much and becomes this big point of contention with the other side, doesn't actually change your life. And if you really want the house, get the house.
When we think about compromise, I would say probably the biggest thing where compromises about money come into play is in our most intimate relationships, whether that is family or someone you love or even a roommate, someone you live with. So when you are entering into a relationship like that, what are the best ways to kind of get your cards out on the table? And do you want to be fully honest?
I mean, I think that if you're not, then aren't you asking for trouble? Come on. I mean, especially in a relationship, it can be with a love relationship. It can be in a familial relationship. It could even be in a business relationship. So I actually think that, you know, just being transparent is easy. Most of our relationships are enhanced by telling the truth and disclosing all the warts and getting it out on the table.
But that's hard for a lot of people to do. So how do you do it?
You know, there's a reason why they say just rip off the Band-Aid. I think if you have a hard time doing it, you may want to do it with a third party. So when I was a financial advisor, I remember that I had these clients, a couple, who basically said to me, you have to tell our adult child that we're cutting them off. And I said, why do I have to do that? That's not my adult child. And we came to a compromise ourselves in that we decided that we'd bring the kid in together, that in front of me, that there was a notion that I could kind of jump in if things got ugly, but that I was there to basically say, hey, kid, my job is to take care of your parents, and your parents can't afford to do what they've been doing, right? And as a result, that kid could almost hear the message better from me than he could from the parents. And we did get through this. And we also kind of negotiated something that was interesting. We said, okay, you're not going to get cut off as of, you know, this day tomorrow. We said, all right, let's do it over 3 months and we're going to kind of scale you back. I think that in some cases, having a third party around can make your life a lot easier. Sometimes that happens even with adult children and their parents. They want to go in and have a conversation about, say, estate planning or care in the home. And you bring in an outside party to make the conversation go a little bit more smoothly. And I think that is very useful.
I want to ask you about a listener who we heard from this week who is looking for an apartment with friends. And so here you've got the question of people making different amounts of money and maybe having different priorities. In a situation like that, where people definitely come from different backgrounds,
yes,
and you know, probably earn different amounts of money, how do you do that and, you know, not drive each other bonkers?
If you're going to have different types of people or different levels of income, what I think is really important is to talk about your worst case scenario. Hey, what would happen if you lost your job? Who's paying the rent? Because the rent, you know, the other, you know, two or three people involved in this transaction can't afford to carry it. And so I think that it would work, but there have to be a lot of tough conversations prior.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money and friend of the show. As always, it's lovely. Thank you.
Take care.
As part of our election coverage, Marketplace teamed up with Edison Research to learn more about how we as Americans think and feel about the economy right now. Whether we feel like insiders, outsiders, how it affects our lives. And since this is the summer, we asked about vacation habits. And here's what we found. Nearly one quarter of the people who responded haven't managed to take a week-long out-of-town vacation in more than 5 years. And if you're right in the middle of the income bracket, say making $50,000 a year, or you work an hourly or part-time job, you're the most likely to be missing out. Which got us thinking, has it always been this hard for the middle class to get out of town on vacation? From the Marketplace desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
I started my middle-class vacation history research, and it was one grueling assignment, let me tell you, on the outskirts of Boulder, Colorado, in lodgings at the foot of the Rocky Mountains, where the air is crisp and the creeks are rushing and the mountain peaks soar in the distance.
Mitchell or Hartman?
Mitchell.
The place I stayed is called the Colorado Chautauqua Center. It's a more than century-old bungalow colony on 26 acres of rolling hills, with nearly 100 cabins, plus lecture and dining halls, gardens, hiking and biking trails.
So it started back in the late 1800s. It was a retreat for Texas teachers.
Receptionist Andrew Smith says the center, which is now a nonprofit National Historic Site, hosted teachers for several decades through the 1920s.
So they'd come up here in the summer, enjoy the cool mountain air, and then attend lectures and that sort of thing.
Now, this was a summer vacation provided by the Texas Board of Regents, basically the school board, costing each teacher $75. room, board, lectures, recreation, for the entire family for 6 weeks, train tickets included. There were Chautauqua camps like this all over the country, part of what historian Patty Limerick calls the
democratization of recreation.
Limerick directs the Center for the American West at the University of Colorado in Boulder, which, among other things, serves as a gateway to the High Rockies, with Vail and Aspen and their multi-million dollar ski chalets, bringing to mind an earlier American Gilded Age before those Texas teachers and other hoi polloi could afford regular road tripping.
The Rockies in the late 19th century, that was quite a leap. And you had to buy railroad tickets, you had to be able to pay for expensive hotels, you had to do lots of things that were really quite exclusive. And that was the whole point, was that it's exclusive.
But, says Limerick, with the New Deal and post-war boom came new prosperity and travel options for the American working class.
By the mid-20th century, that's really transformed. And the affordability of individual automobiles, my goodness, a lot of people had a good time. You can have a dad who's working at a factory and works hard but has making quite a significant wage. And then you can car camp if you need to. And there's a whole proliferation of those kinds of facilities and tiny cabins.
Organized labor also got in the act, promoting the right to a vacation, as Pete Seeger sang in Talking Union, 1941.
You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long, you get shorter hours.
Unions pushed for paid time off. They sent ladies' garment workers to camps in the Catskills.
Take a kid to the seashore.
But organized labor wasn't first to the paid vacation bandwagon, says historian Michael Berkowitz, author of A New Deal for Leisure.
Department store workers in the 1920s are going to vacation camps on a lake on the Jersey Shore, sponsored by their department store.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Berkowitz says it was actually some progressive employers of the day who were most obsessed with getting America's wage earners on vacation. First, salaried workers, from managers to secretaries, who spent their work days
in offices, indoors. They need to be rescued and have activity, be sort of reawakened for productivity and efficiency.
And also manual laborers.
It's really the management literature that starts emerging out of the 1920s, certain studies of fatigue during World War I, that begins to suggest that not only would it be important for salaried brain workers to get paid vacations, but actually wage earners working in industry and factories.
There's another corporate hand pushing vacationing from the Depression right through the post-war car-in-every-garage economic boom, and that's industries related to travel and driving. Here's one famous newscaster broadcasting on behalf of the New York World's Fair in 1964.
I'm Lowell Thomas, standing in front of what will soon be one of the wonders of the modern world.
Thomas's broadcast was sponsored by U.S. Steel, which did better if General Motors sold more cars.
World's Fair, the Unisphere, built by United States Steel.
Berkowitz says this mass media tourism promotion, also funded by motel chains and oil companies and local chambers of commerce, helped solidify the middle class travel habit in America.
World fairs, I think, play a very important role in sort of cultivating this notion. I mean, Disneyland is essentially a permanent World's Fair.
And 50 years ago, with cheap gas and budget hotel chains like Howard Johnson's, Disneyland was affordable as a week-long road trip for a Michigan factory worker's annual summer vacation. Today, maybe not so much. To get back to my little research junket to Colorado, that one-room cabin that cost a Texas teacher's whole family $75 for 6 weeks back in the 1920s, my bill was $190 for one night, taxes not included. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
In the spirit of that story, we have been thinking about vacation and work-life balance. So for next week, we want to know, how do you balance your work and personal time? Are your decisions based on money, family, guilt? You know, that sense that the office can't function without you there? Let us know. Visit our website, Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us at 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Now it's time for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we bring in musicians, writers, and other well-known people and ask them questions about work and money, how it shaped their lives or taught them important lessons. Here's Marketplace producer Raghu Manavalan with this week's guest.
Hello, my name is Senya Rubinos, and I'm a music maker.
First question, fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
shoes. All the shoes. I think I just thought that because I have no shoes right now. I have one pair of shoes right now that I'm wearing to death this summer, and I kind of need new shoes.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Standing up for your idea. Like when you have an original idea for a song or a video or something that you want to say, it's hard to articulate sometimes the ideas that you might have and get other people on board with you and get them excited about it and to get them to see what you're seeing. You know, to ask people to constantly imagine things that they might not see in front of them or might not hear right away. Asking people to have an imagination can be challenging.
Mommy just feel like she needs to breathe today. Today. Give a little space, cause I'm going insane and I just need to breathe today.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
There was like these foie gras French fries that were being sold outside this venue that I played somewhere in the South, mm-hmm. and out of a food truck. And at the time, it seemed like the most luxurious, incredible thing that I could ingest and spend my dollars on. And I definitely regretted it afterwards.
What is your most prized possession?
I really assign a lot of soul to objects. So there's this ring that my cousin gave me, and it's a really cheap ring. I think they just sold it at a street fair or something. But I like this ring that she was wearing. It sounded, made sounds whenever she talked and when she gestured with her hands. They were like these collection of little twinkly stars, and they kind of like hung off her finger and made this twinkly sound when she spoke or when she walked in a room. And I complimented her on it, and she just took it off and gave it to me. And one by one, the stars have fallen off, so now there's like one star left, and I don't wear it anymore. I just keep it. But I used to wear it every day because it reminded me of her, and I don't get to see her very often. She lives in Cuba, but I love that ring.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
It would have been cool to have someone tell me to believe my own hype and only my own hype, and that my ideas and what I create and what I have to say and who I am is enough and is valid and is the most valuable thing that I have, and that I don't have to look outside of myself for something that I want to be, that I already am those things. I think that's maybe good advice. Would be useful to have.
Xenia Rubinos' latest album, Black Terry Cat, is out now. In just 2 weeks, the Summer Olympics start in Rio de Janeiro, and it's anyone's guess whether Brazil is ready. The country is in the middle of a terrible recession, its president has gone through lengthy impeachment proceedings, and a corruption scandal at the national oil company, Petrobras, has ended the careers of numerous politicians and well-connected insiders. All of this is a long way from where Brazil was just a few years ago. Back then, the economy was soaring, and Alex Quadros was writing about the people at the very top as a reporter for Bloomberg News. He's now written a book called Brazilianaires: Wealth, Power, and Hope in an American Country. In it, he writes about trying to pin down the net worth of a particularly flamboyant billionaire.
Part of my job as a quote-unquote billionaires reporter, which was this strange job that I kind of randomly lucked into, was to calculate billionaires' net worths for the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. And when it came time to calculate Ike Batista's net worth, during the process, he was so intent on showing how much he was worth that his people listed, you know, the private jets he owned, the yachts, and sent accompanying photos. A lot of it was pretty straightforward because he owned shares in big publicly traded companies, but they argued with us on one point. We were trying to put the value on a gold company that owned gold deposits in Colombia, but had yet to extract an ounce of gold from the ground. So we compared it to other similar companies and determined it was worth slightly less than $1 billion. He said that it was worth $5 billion. And we decided to go with our number, and he got so upset over this that on the eve of the launch of the index, he called me personally to try and convince me that I was wrong and proceeded to yell at me for like 15, 20 minutes and telling me how it had a lot more gold than we knew about and how he was going to make me look very foolish and how he would tweet that I was lying about his assets. And during that conversation, he even called me primitive, which is the only time a billionaire has ever called me a name.
Why write about the billionaires?
It wasn't something that I was that interested in before. Before I started working for Bloomberg, I was a lot more interested in writing about the poor. But what I realized is that I had actually stumbled onto a really unique way of looking at the country at this kind of special moment that it was having. And not only that, but I had stumbled onto a story that's important well beyond Brazil. I got a kind of access to people that very few people get to talk to on a regular basis, billionaires.
Well, what can they teach you? What can a billionaire of a country teach you about a country?
When you talk to a Brazilian billionaire, you learn a lot about ideas of success, where success comes from. You learn a lot about the ideals of the country. To go back to Ike Batista, when I spoke to him after he was done yelling at me, he told me, you know, what's happening in Brazil right now is the Brazilian dream, and I happen to be the example of that dream. He expressed this idea, a very new idea in Brazil, which is a country with terrible inequality and social stratification, that anyone could get rich if they tried hard enough and worked hard enough and so on, which is obviously a very common mythology in the United States, but something very new there. Now, what's interesting about this is that it was just that, a myth. I mean, his dad was a government minister, served as CEO of Vale, the mining giant. Ike liked to say that he grew up middle class, but he grew up with access to things that one in 1,000 or 100,000 or a million Brazilians grow up with.
Why do you think things started to unravel?
Partly luck and partly bad decisions. The luck part is that commodity prices started to come down. China's economy started to slow, and you know, oil and iron ore and beef started to be worth less on global markets. So that was a big blow to Brazil. The bad decisions part is that Dilma Rousseff, who was president from 2011 and is currently being impeached and may definitively be forced to step down very soon, pursued a very strange idea of economic development. I think we hear outside of Brazil a lot about the social programs of those years under her and
Familia,
Lula.
We heard, direct payments to the poorest of the poor. We hear about that. But you wrote about sort of her economic strategy. Clearly, you feel like it was sort of misguided. So tell me why.
The strangest contradiction in this ostensibly left-wing movement is that they thought the state could guide economic development by funneling subsidies to the sectors they favored. The problem is that they didn't discriminate very much, and they funneled hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies to billionaire-owned companies through tax breaks, through subsidized low-interest government loans. And what it seems like some researchers believe to have happened is not that this increased investments, because while she was doing this, the economy started to sputter and finally plunge into recession, but it just helped increase profit margins for these companies. And at the same time, it saddled Brazil with this massive debt. And Brazil is a country with very high interest rates. So shortly before Dilma was forced to step down because of the impeachment proceedings, but by her last year in office, her government was spending just on interest payments the equivalent of 12 years of the Bolsa Família welfare program.
You know, with the exception of Dilma, all of the main characters in this book are male. And when you talk about billionaires giving you a window into national goals and identities and themes, boy, it was really hard to read this as a woman and not be like, wait, where are the women in here? Were you struck by that in reporting it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a very male book, but not through my choice, but because this is a reflection of what wealth looks like in Brazil. I do profile one very rich woman, but she inherited her fortune from her husband. When you look at the billionaire rankings in Brazil, you're seeing a picture of the entrenched inequality and machismo in the country.
And race. Most of the people are white. Yeah.
Not a single Brazilian billionaire is black. And, you know, this is, I think, a surprise to some outsiders who see Brazil as this example of racial harmony. But in fact, racism is just quieter there. It's a lot more subtle. There's a rapper named Emicida who says that what's hard is to fight this cordial kind of racism.
What does that mean, cordial racism?
There's a cliche about the archetypal Brazilian that he's the cordial man. This is partly a reference to how business has always been done in the country based on personal relationships rather than through impersonal institutions. But there's also a mythology of the Brazilian within Brazil as innately friendly and warm and welcoming. But oftentimes this friendliness is covering up deep social inequalities and problems. And racism is one of those things.
So I spent 2 weeks in Brazil in 2015 making a documentary. And one of the things that came up again and again was this idea of sort of inside-outside, that for a lot of Brazilians, mostly middle-class people, that inside the home life had improved. So people had TVs and refrigerators and, you know, nice stuff, and families had better housing. But outside the home, in terms of social services and transportation and education and healthcare, that they hadn't. I'm curious whether that tracks with your reporting, and if it does, when that outside part is going to fall into place.
Well, absolutely. And I think that one of the biggest failures of the Workers' Party years was not to invest more in the outside the home part of life for working class Brazilians. They pushed huge subsidies to a beer company, to the subsidiary of the world's largest beer company, which is controlled by a Brazilian billionaire named Jorge Paulo Lehmann. But they failed to do enough to extend basic sanitation to, you know, poor rural homes and even poor urban homes. Half the population lacks access to basic
sanitation. And we're talking
about
a government that at one point was led by an ex-unionist and another point an ex-left-wing guerrilla.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is a very interesting moment because we have the Olympics coming up, and the Olympics are emblematic of this kind of decision making. The authorities in Brazil, from the president, Dilma, on down to the mayor of Rio, decided that they were going to invest hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, if you include the World Cup stadiums, in sporting facilities. And this was very good for the well-connected billionaire construction families who built them. and for the local politicians who got to spread the funds around. But it doesn't make much sense when there are these urgent infrastructure needs of poor Brazilians. And it fits into this strange trickle-down idea of development.
I'm not going to ask you if Brazil can pull the Olympics off, because I don't think that's a question we can answer right now. I want to know what you think the legacy of the campaigning for these Olympics will be and the things that were built or not built for them.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when Brazil won the right to hold the Olympics in 2009, it was a party. People were celebrating on Copacabana Beach in Rio. Now the feeling about the Olympics is very different. Obviously, there were huge protests over the World Cup. Now people aren't protesting, but I think only because they've kind of been beaten down too much by their circumstances. You know, so I hope one legacy of this will be skepticism about these kind of glorious, hubristic plans presented to them by their leaders. More concretely, when we look at the city of Rio, it's going to be a legacy that disproportionately benefits a wealthier slice of the population. In a city where 1 in 7 people live in favelas, they decided to put the lion's share of Olympic investments in a wealthy suburb called Barra da Tijuca, where only 300,000 people live. So the single most expensive Olympic project is a subway extension that connects Ipanema and Leblon, two of the fanciest
neighborhoods,
to Barra da Tijuca, this wealthy suburb, and neglected other parts of the city that woefully need this kind of thing.
Alex Quadros is the author of Brazilianaires. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, how do you balance your work and personal time? And what are your decisions based on? Money, family, guilt? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills, Raghu Manavalan, and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. And Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and thanks for listening. This is APM.